We're on the record. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee. Today's date is April 3rd, 2012. Time is about 9:03 in the morning. We have with us Senator Pasvan, Senator Giesel, Senator Meyer. Senator Kukesh is on his way. We have one resolution and three bills before us. First, we have Senate Joint Resolution Number 20, which urges Congress and the Department of Defense to reconsider the transfer of F-16s from Eielson Air Force Base and recognize the strategic importance of the base. Second is House Bill 205, which amends the state's procurement code with regard to preferences, such as Alaska's bidder's preference, the Alaska's veteran's preference, and others. Third, we have HB 169, which concerns the review of regulations by the Legislative Affairs Agency. And last, we have House Bill 216, which also addresses the adoption of regulations. We'll begin with Senate Joint Resolution, recently the number 20. Recently, the Air Force announced that it was recommending the relocation of the 18th F-16 Aggressor Squadron from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. This would reduce the operational capacity of Eielson, making it vulnerable to potential base closure. Senator Pasvan is carrying this resolution. Senator, if you could give us a brief overview of the resolution, and I know we have your committee staff here as well. The floor is yours.
All right. I guess just as a brief introduction, you know, the United States Air Force has recommended the relocation of the 18th F-16 Aggressor Squadron from Eielson Air Force Base, located in interior Alaska, and I believe that this is wrong. This move will have a dramatic impact on the Fairbanks economy in general, and certainly I believe all of interior Alaska, and it will reduce the operational capacities at Eielson, making it vulnerable for future base realignment and closure rounds, and I believe that this is detrimental to the entire state of Alaska. The benefits and strategic importance of Eielson Air Force Base now and into the future far outweigh any negligible savings, if any, achieved by the transfer of the F-16 squadron. Eielson Air Force Base is at the forefront of protecting the United States' interests in the Pacific Theater and serves a critical function in reinforcing the region. It helps to secure important pipeline infrastructure, including the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, and also the refineries that are located in interior Alaska. This provides provides a significant portion of the nation's energy needs, and Eielson Air Force Base also has an adjacent access to the largest joint air and land training range in the United States. This area's minimal airspace congestion is well suited to perform operations for unmanned vehicles and live fire exercises. And with respect to the unmanned vehicles, this is where the 21st century military capabilities are going. Further, Eielson is connected to the largest unrestricted airspace in the United States. The base itself has large fuel storage capacity and has a runway capable of handling the military's largest aircraft year-round. Movement of the 18th F-16 Aggressor Squadron puts Eielson Air Force Base at risk. This base has served America's needs for decades and, because of its location, should continue to serve America's interests. The base has access to unique training grounds, fuel storage, ample housing for its servicemen and women and their families, and provides critical support for the joint training exercises. As a lifelong Alaska resident, and certainly a lifelong Fairbanks resident, I understand the significance of Eielson Air Force Base to the communities of interior Alaska and to our country's security interests. During 2005, the last base closure and realignment round, the strategic and economic importance of Eielson Air Force Base was proved. I would encourage members of this committee to support this resolution, and this resolution does seek to remind the President and the Air Force that the F-16 should stay at Eielson Air Force Base. So thank you. I think in part that's what this resolution is all about, Mr. Chair, and again would request your and the other committee members' support for this resolution.
All right. Thank you, Senator Pasvan. And we're joined by Senator Kukesh, and I neglected to mention that we have had Representative Fairclough here since we started. Questions for the bill resolution? Sponsor? Okay, I don't see any. I don't know that we need additional presentation by your staff, but do we have anyone online wanting to testify?
There overwhelmed at the bridge, so it's going to be a second before I go.
Okay. Is there anyone in the room wanting to testify? Okay, I don't see any. Let's take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. We're having some technical difficulties, but I think we know who's online, and we think that Mayor Hopkins from the Fairbanks North Star Borough is there. Mayor, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your brief testimony.
Yes, thank you very much. This is Mayor Luke Hopkins, Fairbanks North Star Borough. I appreciate this resolution. It is yet another statement that the state of Alaska should and must make. I have heard many overview discussions in the United States Senate and the House that causes me to question the basis for the movement of the F-16s from Eielson to J-Bear, and understanding that there is a congressional budget reduction called for and seen in the FY13 federal funding proposals. The proposed savings that are called for in the DOD budget through this action in the out years make me question whether there really is a savings, and our community is taking steps to work with consultants both locally and in Washington, D.C. to build the issue of whether or not there really is savings that will occur, and if not, then why are they being moved? The other aspect of it, of course, is, as we just see, the draft EIS has come out for the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, and in that it shows that Eielson is not only on the edge of it, but Eielson is a direct link for both manned and unmanned activities that will be supported in this J-Park as we see future training sessions go on, which are so important to both the United States in its strategic position and with its allies' forces. So I ask that pass this out of committee and send it on its way, and I hope the rest of the legislature acts quickly. This is a time-sensitive item. Thank you very much, and I would be glad to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Mayor, for your testimony. Any questions? I don't see any. Okay, next up we've got Doug Isaacson, the mayor of North Pole. Mayor, welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony, and brevity will be appreciated.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I'm Doug Isaacson, the mayor of the city of North Pole. And I want to thank you all for taking up this resolution. And to be brief, I support the sponsor statement, Senator Pascal's introduction to this a moment ago, and what Mayor Hopkins said. Just to augment it very briefly was the idea of expanding the mission at Eielson as well. Consider that Eielson has is in the process actually of completing about 900 new base housing units and has recently completed new facilities for its commissary, base exchange, chapel, and a lot of the operations out there. And so it seems odd that at this time they would consider a reduction when this is could, as the mayor said, actually cost them much more. The other aspect was the quality of life. The community really, really supports our military up here, and we take care of their airmen when and the families when they're deployed you might say a happy airman is an effective airman, or better yet, when the warrior doesn't have to worry about the welfare of his family back home, he's an effective warrior. So with all that has been said and your request be brief, I just want to speak in favor of this resolution and encourage the legislature to adopt it in whole. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. I don't see any questions. Next up, we have Jim Dodson. Jim, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Jim Dodson, Fairbanks, Alaska. I am president of Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. In 2005, I represented both the Fairbanks North Star Borough and the state of Alaska in the BRAC action, a BRAC action intended to close Allison Air Force Base. In 2005, the BRAC Commission determined that the financial information that was being used by the Air Force was inaccurate. Today, even though there is no adjudicating body like a BRAC committee, under intense questioning from our congressional delegation, the Air Force has been unwilling or unable to document the numbers they're using to move the 19 F-16s from Eielson to J-Bear. We believe this action is in error, as it was in 05, and the Air Force is using inaccurate numbers. We appreciate this joint resolution and support the sponsor statement. So I appreciate your efforts and thank you for your support.
All right, thank you, Mr. Dodson. Any questions? Don't see any. Is there anyone else online wanting to testify? I don't see any. Anyone else in the room wanting to testify? I don't see any. We're going to close public testimony. And any final comments by the Senator Pasternak?
Well, I just do thank both the mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough and the mayor of the city of North Pole and the president of the Fairbanks Economic Development, for taking the time to provide testimony on this and would hope for adoption.
Okay, thank you. This is is there a motion to move the resolution from committee with attached zero fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move Senate Joint Resolution number 20 from this committee to the next committee of referral with attached fiscal note.
Is there any discussion? See any objection? I don't see any. Okay, the resolution is moved.
And
all right, let's move on to House Bill 205, which addresses preferences in the state procurement code. The bill consolidates some preferences and sets standards for how they accumulate. Representative Fairclough and her staff, Laura Pierre, are here. Welcome to the committee. You can put yourself on the record and present the bill.
Good morning, Chairman Milikowski, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. My name is Representative Anna Fairclough, Eagle River, Alaska. And before you today is HB 205, a bill that changes and streamlines the procurement code to ensure consistency in application of the law, resulting in a more understandable, efficient procurement process. It eliminates a seldom-used preference for employers with disabilities. It consolidates procurement preferences under one statute, and it clarifies which preferences are cumulative and those that may not be combined. It makes application of preferences uniform. Currently, the preferences do not contain the same language, so they must be applied differently. With that, we can go through a sectional analysis if you would like, and if I might have Vern Jones from the procurement office join us.
Yeah. Why don't you pull up a chair, Vern, and how are you? For any questions for the bill sponsor before we get started? I don't see any. Okay. However you want to walk through the bill, Representative Fairclough would, but if we could do a sectional, that'd be helpful.
We'll start with the sectional, and then if I could ask Mr. Jones to supplement that so the committee has a full understanding of what the language does.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Laura Pierre, staff to Representative Fairclough. I'll briefly walk you through the bill. It's pretty technical. as far as just moving statute from one number to another number in statute. We're creating a whole new section of procurement to align the statutes of procurement statutes.
And if you could just tell us which, as you go through, which ones are substantive changes and which ones are just sort of numbering changes or procedural changes, that'd be helpful.
Absolutely. Section 1, this would just be a renumbering of the preference. You'll see that the old statute number is 3630170B. The new statute number is 3630321A. And you'll see that multiple times throughout the bill.
And just on that point, why, and you can answer, maybe Vern can answer, why are we renumbering things and shuffling them around?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Vern Jones. I'm the state's chief procurement officer. In answer to your question, what we're trying to do is pull the preferences out of the various sections in statute and put them all in one section, and to make their language uniform so that they are more easily applied and they're more consistently applied.
So is it fair to say that right now we have preferences scattered all throughout the statutes, and for instance section 36 on this one, and you're just pulling everything, putting it in one easy to find location?
That's it.
Okay, all right, thank you. Section 2,
this amends the local agriculture preference to grant a 7% cost preference to the qualifying bid rather than to the low bid, and this is making the preference consistent with other procurement preferences currently in statute.
Hold on that one. So explain that to me again. So we're changing it from the low bid to
a 7% preference.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the way the statute is written now, the language, I believe it says, you must award to the bidder that qualifies for this preference if their bid is within a certain percentage of the low bid. So what a procurement person has to do now is go through, apply a certain set of preferences, figure out who the low bid, low bidder is, take the 7% of that amount and deduct it from the qualifying bidder's bid. It's a complicated process. Instead of just, what's your bid amount? Do you qualify? If yes, reduce that by 7%, which is what the change would do. It's a much simpler, more straightforward, more mathematical
thing. And when you say if you qualify, is that just some basic minimum qualifications that you meet?
Specifically to this one, if you qualify as producing a local agricultural or fisheries product.
Okay, so the way the new bill would work, this new section, is the procurement officer would go through and say, okay, this person is in Washington, so he obviously doesn't qualify. This person is in Wasilla. Qualify, they get the 7% deduction, or 7% preference.
Yes, sir, essentially.
Okay. Senator Bassett?
And as I understand what you're saying is that by going to the definition of qualifying bid, that's the bid that would have received the award but for any preference.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but through the chair, Senator Pascavan, what we're trying to do here is base the preference on the individual that's applying and is qualified to obtain that preference. You take a percentage off of their bid instead of figuring out who the low bidder is, applying a preference to that, getting an amount, and reducing the qualifying bidder's bid by that amount. We're just saying that if you qualify for a 7% preference, we're taking 7% off of your bid price.
Okay.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think you mentioned this last time on a different bill, but can you give us examples of when you would go with a low bid versus a qualifying bid?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the only time, it's sort of a misnomer, because when it talks about the low bid, you haven't applied this preference yet. So what you have to do currently is go through, apply, say, all but this agricultural and fisheries product preference and say, okay, absent this preference, who would the low bidder be? And now is this bidder who qualifies for this preference within 7% of that? Instead of doing that, process. We're just simply saying, do you qualify for this? The preference is worth 7%. We're deducting 7% from your bid. So it's sort of a misnomer the way the statute now refers to this, because a low bid isn't a low bid until we're done applying all of the preferences, including the one at stake here.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Passman.
Just so that I understand, when you say you take that 7% off their bid, then that becomes their imputed bid, and even though the award is at the written amount, not the 7% off.
Through the chair, yes, that's right. What we're talking about here, applying all these preferences, is for evaluation purposes only. The contract resulting is always for the amount that the bidder offers, and we're just evaluating these preferences when we make an award.
Does this have the ability to change the results of procurement? I'm trying.
Certainly, application of preferences often.
I mean this the law change. So in other words, if we had a procurement under the current law and then we had a procurement under this change, could there be different results?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there could be, because the low bid is by definition a lower amount, and then when we take a percentage of that amount, it's less than if you were just to simply take a percentage off of the bidder's amount. So in actuality, by changing the methodology of applying these preferences, oftentimes it amounts to a greater benefit, a greater amount discounted by the preference. Not significant, but yes.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The purpose of this section is to clarify language, as Vern has stated, but it's also to make sure that Alaska-owned businesses that are providing or harvesting in seafood or agriculture get that edge, because they compete in a market where some large supplier, whether it's a Costco or a big box store, can bring in hundreds of thousands of heads of lettuce, and we're trying to make sure that our own schools that we're using state money for, as well as our prison facilities, use locally grown products and try to give the edge to agriculture specific under this section for that purpose.
All right, thank you. Okay, section 3.
Section 3 essentially does exactly what section 2 did, just to local fisheries. The section 2 was for agriculture. This is for local fisheries.
Okay. Questions? I don't see any. Section 4.
Section 4 would amend the local agriculture and fisheries preference to not allow a bidder being granted both a local agriculture fisheries preference and Alaska product preference. This is so credits wouldn't be stackable.
Okay, explain.
Mr. Chairman, these preferences are somewhat duplicative, and you don't want to have more than one preference for the same thing. So what this is saying is you can't have both an agricultural and fisheries product preference as well as an Alaskan product preference, because you're essentially getting the same preferences for the same things compounded on one another.
Okay. And under current law, is that the case? Can you do that?
That's in our practice, and this just makes it explicit, I think.
So the practice is that you don't allow stacking?
For certain preferences, we don't, and this is one of them, and this just makes it all the more clear that you're not qualified to get more than one preference for the same thing, a like grouping of preferences.
Do you have a question, Senator Passman?
So as I understand what you're saying, then the bidder, for example, a local agricultural bidder, would likely elect the 7% preference as compared to the Alaska 5%?
Through the chair.
Explain.
Senator Pascavan, the Alaska products preference actually is a three-tiered system. There's a three 5 and a 7% preference based on the percentage produced or manufactured in the state. But so, for example, a fisheries product, maybe it's fertilizer, if it's produced 100% in the state, would get a 7% preference. But you wouldn't also want to get, we would be duplicating this if we also gave them the fisheries product preference in addition to the Alaskan products preference. And what this is saying is you get either one but not both.
Great. Okay, next section.
Sections 5 through 10 are all renumbering.
Okay, so we're on, so 5 through 10 are all
renumbering.
Okay, so
section 11. This adds a new section consolidating the Alaska bidder preference, the Alaska veterans preference, and other preferences formerly under the 363170B. This section also simplifies the qualification for the disability and employment program preferences, and it eliminates the seldom used employers of people with disability preferences and excludes real estate leases from application of procurement preferences. And Vern can give you some examples and go into more detail on this particular section.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a big section, and I'm wondering if there's a way that we can take it in smaller bites, maybe, Vern?
Like, Mr. Chairman, I can explain what this does and the rationale. First of all, right now, the disability-related preference, there's three of them. There's the employment program, there's the disabled bidder preference, and there's the employers of the disabled preference, whereby you get a preference if you employ 50% or more of your workforce that are disabled. One of the things this does is eliminates that third preference for people who employ disabled people, for businesses who employ disabled people. What we found is that, as you're probably gathering by now, we've got a lot of these preferences. It's sort of complicated, and this one preference is very seldom used. We have only known of two firms that have ever claimed the preference. It's always been a situation where, to my knowledge, there's a firm and they may have a spin-off company and they have one employee who's disabled, and it might be a relative. So 100% of their employees are disabled, and now they all of a sudden get a preference. So to my knowledge, that preference is benefiting two businesses and a total of two people, and I don't think that was what's intended. And if we eliminate that, we still have the employment program and the disabled bidder preference. So I think that's seldom used and sometimes subject to, I won't say that. It can be taken advantage of.
Senator Meyer has a question.
Well, and I may be premature, maybe you're going to explain this, but what is the maximum preference a bidder could get? I mean, is there 15%, 20%, and that's the cap, or is there a cap? I mean, I'm just thinking, well, if I'm an Alaska company and I hire mostly disabled veterans and, the list goes on and on, how?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I'm not sure I would have to sit down with pen in hand and maybe come up with an example of that to answer your question. I would say it's probably in the neighborhood of 12 to 15%. But it's complicated by the fact that we also, in regulation, have a offeror's preference, which we're not dealing with here today, that is a percentage of an RFP in addition to all these. What we're talking about today is price-based preferences. So it's really hard to tell when you add that 10% overall preference in an RFP. It could be upwards of 15%, which in some industries is completely blows out the difference between the lowest performing and highest performing firm, making it a non-competitive situation. But I'd say typically we always see the 5% preference. Then you may have, depending on the product, an Alaska product or a fisheries or agricultural product. And then if it's an RFP, you have another preference. So they're substantial when you add them all together. What this bill does is try and, you know, it eliminates one that's seldom used and I think subject to some abuse, and it makes them easier to apply.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let's take something that's a little easier to understand, like a road. And I'm bidding on a road. I could be the high bidder, but once you apply my 12-15% preference, then I could still get the bid, is what you're saying.
Through the chair, generally speaking, on a road project, you would have the 5% bidder preference, and you would have probably, if you were bidding aggregate that was produced 100% in Alaska, that would be another 7%. So you'd have 12% preference on your price.
And then what do you have to get if you hire so many disabled folks, you get another preference?
But that would be the disabled bidder preference. I believe that's 7% preference as well.
Okay. And that may be hard to do in a road project. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Senator Passman.
Yeah. Well, I'm focusing upon this area that you've raised, that there's only two companies, and you know, it raises the question is what is the type of work that the company does in order to receive the bid that they're submitting under? In other words, does the disabled, you know, if it's 100% disabled workforce, as you've indicated, but what is the type of work that is being submitted, or the type of solicitation that the state is receiving? You know, what is it that it applies to, and what's the magnitude of the dollars?
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, one firm is a business that offers office space leases to the state, and another firm is one that does construction. So their sole employee in the office is a disabled person, but it's a construction firm. I don't know that particular firm has ever gotten a contract as a result of this, but I know that the firm that offers lease space to the state has. And I guess you probably ask yourself, you know, it's a building. Why are we giving a preference to a building that we're leasing over another building? To me, it doesn't make sense. And in fact, one of the things that this section does is when it carries over and puts all the preferences in one place, it doesn't carry over. It actually explicitly excludes real estate leases. So that's another important thing here. We're not giving any preference to a real estate lease because, by definition, with few exceptions, all of the leases, all of the office space we lease is in the state. So we don't think it makes any sense to apply preference to it.
So just to make sure I understand then, if, as it's currently written, the employee or the employer that has 100% disabled workforce, they could obtain a lease by bidding $107,000, and the other bid was at $100,000, and they get it for $107,000.
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
And that's changing that circumstance.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the reasons why it's included in a bill that I'm sponsoring is the reason that I believe the legislature provides preferences is so the population of Alaska can benefit from that. And when we look at disability preferences, as an example, we want multiple people, and we want employers to hire multiple people and provide a work environment for those people. Under the instance at how it's been used over the past years, very limited people with disabilities are actually seeing benefit of an employer offering something to multiple people. And so if only one person is benefiting or is hired under this preference, is it a good public policy for us to continue that practice if we're not really, from my perspective, getting what we want, and that is employers to hire people with disabilities in different arenas, in different work environments.
Senator Passman.
And I agree with that, and it seems that it would make more sense, assuming you wanted to keep the 50% disabled workforce standard, that the work that was being done was connected with the disability. As compared to here, there's no connection between the disability and the product or service or whatever it is that the state's receiving. And that's where you have, as I understand you're explaining, the complete disconnect between the preference and what the state's receiving as connected to any disability.
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, I think you hit the nail on the head. There is no connection there, as opposed to the employment program preference that remains. In employment programs, what we used to call a sheltered workshop, we still have, it's a 10% preference for that. And we also still would have a disabled bidder preference. So if you're the bidder and you're disabled, and sole proprietorship, or if you're a partnership and all of the partners are disabled, you also would still be able to get a preference here. And that those two examples, I think there would be a connection between the actual people involved and the work being done.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the purpose of Section 11.2 is to clarify the stackability and how the calculation is actually done. When Mr. Jones and I originally met almost 3 years ago now, one of the examples that he provided to me were, as you've heard today and last week under a different bill, the complication in having different preferences located throughout state statutes. And so they're not combined so that people who are growing something really understand how and how much can be calculated for their preferences. And this particular section says explicitly what can be stacked and how the procurement officer can make that calculations, which will provide clarity and a lot less confusion for Alaskans who might try to access the preferences, as well as the administration for applying those preferences in the mathematical calculation to select the award recipient.
Senator Passman.
Again, following up on this example with the 50% disabled workforce issue, as I understand, some subsidiary entity was created where in that entity was the one person. And so ultimately my question goes to, has there been any attempt by the administration to, you know, strip away this subsidiary entity and say, look, it's really the benefit is not going to the one disabled person that's in that subsidiary entity, it's going to this other entity. Is that, in other words, piercing the corporate veil, you know, you go and say, who is the true recipient of these state monies that are being received under the preference, and all you are is having a front man, so to speak, that's manipulating the system. In other words, it's, you know, so to speak, an evil of capitalism if you allow them to manipulate the system without going to the real heart of the deal.
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, that's part of the issue we're trying to address here, but these preferences don't require any sort of benefit to be derived by the disabled people involved. I think you get closer to that when you have a preference for a sheltered workshop or an employment program, or you have a preference for disabled bidders. But technically, if right now, if 50% or more of your workforce is disabled, you qualify, and there isn't any requirement for those, you know, specific employees to do any specific things as long as they're your employees. And that's one of the reasons why we're eliminating this, not only because it's so seldom used, but we don't think it's accomplishing its purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with that, and my, I guess my question was more broad in the sense, are there other areas where you believe the state of Alaska is getting scammed and you use a front corporation to do the scamming, and then the state of Alaska just sits back and says, oh, we don't want to look at what's really happening, but we know we're getting scammed for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars. In other words, that's the policy issue that we're trying. We focused on one area here that we're believing is a misuse of a law in Alaska. The question is, are there other areas that you have identified that are potentially misuses of the law?
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, there are other areas that we had in previous bills, but they were controversial and they are not included in this bill. 2 years ago, we offered the elimination of the offer's preference that is currently being used through regulation. And it was our belief, my belief, that we should have preferences in state statute and not in regulation. That bill stalled in committee and did not move forward based on controversy surrounding that preference. This bill is an attempt to do all that we can to reach consensus and the greatest compliance that we can get to be able to change the current system. And should we want to attack or take up the discussion on the offeror's preference, that certainly is a possibility. We would prefer it not to be in this bill. We have the support of the chamber. We have the support, I believe, of all people involved in this process and 2 years ago's process, but there are other areas of controversy that are not included in this bill.
Thank you. I do remember at the end of session 2 years ago when that controversy erupted.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, there's one other important change in section 11 that I'd like to point out, and that is starting in section J, we list section K, we list a number of third-party qualifications that would indicate disability when we're applying these employment program and disabled bidder preferences. We have had complaints from the vendor community, especially from disabled veterans in the past, about the current process. And we've also had complaints, and this bill is supported by the folks in the Division of Voc Rehab, Vocational Rehabilitation, because the process right now is their law, their regulation requires them to get doctor's notes from people and to evaluate them to determine whether they are actually disabled and qualify for this preference or not. That's problematic for them because they say they really don't have the qualification to make those kinds of determinations, and also they're having to review confidential information that really is not their business. And what this bill does is it substitutes in third-party qualifications such as the VA disability or the Social Security or even state authorities where authorities have gone in and determined someone is disabled. So now Voc Rehab can just take that and adopt that as their conclusion as well, and they don't have to go through an evaluation process to determine if somebody's disabled that they're not qualified to do. I think this would be easier for Voc Rehab to make their determinations, and it would also be easier for those businesses out there, especially disabled veterans, to just simply prove that they're disabled by providing the paperwork for that a competent authority has already given them.
How do we prove disability now?
Is an evaluation process on a case-by-case basis by the Division of Voc Rehab, and it generally requires the petitioner to go to their doctor to get them to write a letter explaining their disability that they would have to have been evaluated in Voc Rehab. And it's a cumbersome process, one that they're not well equipped to evaluate. And we think this is just a much better. In fact, we worked with Voc Rehab on this section to try and capture all the third party common entities out there that make these sorts of determinations.
Senator Myers, a question.
Thank you. And so I'm assuming there's some protection to the state. I mean, if we did hire, say, a disabled firm and somebody got hurt on the job, then we're protected from any liability.
Senator Meyer, we typically have standard insurance requirements dictated by the Division of Risk Management that we include in our contracts that protect the state. Yes.
Okay. I figured as such. And if I may, now what if I'm in charge of putting out the bid? Let's say the crime lab in Anchorage, and it's very specialized, technical, and you know I just feel like there's only one or two bidders that could really do this job right. Can I request a sole source?
Through the chair, it's possible to request a sole source, and I guess the real determination there is that the competent official that reviews that documentation and whether the single source in this case would qualify under our statutes. There are some stringent requirements for single source approvals in our statute.
Okay, but we do it.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Are we on page 7, line 6, we're saying a person has to be permanently disabled, and currently is that the law, or do we allow temporary disability to get a bidder's preference?
Through the chair, I believe that's consistent with current statute.
Senator Passer?
Well, yeah, in other words, getting to the circumstance that you raised here 10 minutes ago, is there any provision in the procurement statutes where someone manipulates a system that they are subject to criminal prosecution? In other words, if somebody's out there and they're just, you know, affirmatively putting together sham legal entities to, in essence, take money from the state of Alaska, shouldn't there be criminal prosecution potential?
Through the chair, actually on specific to preferences, the Alaska product preference does have a penalty for claiming a preference and then not providing the product on which the preference was granted in the bid. But in addition to that, there's a requirement of good faith in our procurement statute, and if someone perpetrates fraud on the state, they would certainly be subject to criminal penalties and debarment.
You know, the covenant of good faith and fair dealing is implied in a contractual civil sense, but what I'm hearing is that no is the answer to criminal prosecution.
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, I'm not an attorney, but my understanding is if you perpetrate a fraud in submitting a proposal, if you falsify information, that is a crime, and it can be prosecuted by the Attorney General.
Again, that gets into that tautology. If they use this legal entity, but then there's no process or even an intent to pierce that legal entity to get at where the focus is, then it's in effect a meaningless issue. And anyway, I'm just struggling with that whole concept of when one can literally intentionally manipulate the system, create a legal entity, that legal entity is a sham, they can recover lots of money from the state of Alaska, and at most their risk is civil at the moment.
Any comment?
No, sir.
Senator Kukesh.
I just want to know, under the scenario Senator Pascoe is talking about, has a state ever been subject to a fraud such as that, or a sham, as he put it?
Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, there's been several times that preferences were claimed that we later found out that the bidder didn't qualify for. And in those cases, I know of, there was no contract awarded, and it was a situation where the marketplace sort of policed itself. But I know of no other circumstances.
Thank you.
Under the current definition of permanently disabled, is that, and I don't know enough about each one of these standards, but for Social Security, for example, I think it's a pretty high bar. I believe you have to be permanently totally disabled. For workers' comp, you say you have to be permanently totally disabled. Are we changing this? In other words, if someone is blind, let's say, they may not be permanently totally disabled. They may have some lesser disability. Are we foreclosing people who are not permanently totally disabled?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, we're not really changing the percentage of disability or what the disability is on this determination. We're simply shifting who makes the determination. Now it's the Division of Voc Rehab. And they don't feel they have the wherewithal and the qualifications to make that requirement. What we're doing in this bill is we're adopting third-party qualification standards. So if someone submits a paperwork from the VA or Social Security Administration, we're accepting that, and we're not making that determination.
But the standard right now, is it just permanently disabled? Is it permanently disabled according to the Division of Voc Rehab?
That's my understanding.
And is that a total disability standard, or, I mean, I guess people who are permanently totally disabled probably have a hard time going back to work. So I don't.
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that in order to be certified now by Voc Rehab, they have to make the determination that they have, that the individual has some bar to employment, so they have some level of disability, and frankly, I'm not sure what their standard is.
And maybe if we could get a little better answer on this, because I'm just curious if we're setting a much higher standard of disability than we currently have. Do you know, Representative Faircloth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll get back to the committee with that answer. My understanding is this is setting a bar that is consistent with the current standard, but is alleviating the department or the Division of Vocational Ed from having to do that. In other words, the people of Alaska who have disabilities have already qualified under one of the avenues that we're presenting to you today, and they each have, as you know, a little bit different standards, but they are different. They are different and then the same as what we're doing today. It just removes a duplication of process that the individual Alaskan is having to do to qualify under our code, but we're happy to go back to Voc Ed and ask.
Right. Yeah, I understand what you're trying to get at. I think it's laudable. I'm just curious if we're, because Social Security, well, I'm looking at workers' comp, which is the one I'm familiar with. That's a total disability standard. That's a very high. I mean, you've got to be, you're basically having an adjudication from workers' comp that you are unable to work. The Social Security standard, I believe, is a very high standard. That's, you have doctors saying this person cannot work. So I'm just trying to figure out, because you can have the difference between being 0 disabled and 100% disabled. There's a huge magnitude in there, and I just want to make sure we're not shutting out people that may be 25% disabled or 50% disabled, who are really the ones that we're probably trying to target with this bill or with this the preferences. Other questions on this section? Okay, are we done with section 12?
11.
I'm sorry, 11. Let's move on to 12.
Mr. Chairman, section 12, this is similar to what we saw in Sections 2 and 3 when we talked about the agriculture and the fisheries, the 7% preference, this would be used on local forest products. Section 13. This clarifies in statute which preferences are cumulative and which may not be combined. Vern talked about, and like an example would be, bidders cannot claim both an employment program preference and a disabled bidder preference. So I think currently they make the determination, and this would just make it explicit in statute.
Okay.
Section 14, and this is moving the definition for Alaska bidder to the new section, the new statute, so from 3630-170. And then Sections 15 and 16, this is renumbering of the preference. And Section 17, this repeals the statute establishing the veteran preference. And the reason behind this is because it's been moved to the new section 3630-321F. And it also repeals employment program language, not the preference itself, and relationship to other preferences. And Section 18, this clarifies the application of the Procurement Act to pending solicitations during the transition period. So when this becomes law, anything that's currently pending, the Procurement Office and the contractor could come to an agreement to have this apply to their current contract if both parties agreed. But this would not be automatically retroactive to any pending contracts. And then Section 19 is the effective date, which is immediately.
All right. So are there any new preferences contained in this bill?
No.
Okay. And are there any preferences that are substantially amended, to your knowledge?
Mr. Chair, aside from the employers of the disabled preference that is eliminated, the bill exempts lease of office space, real estate leases from preferences, and it also makes those changes to the third party qualification for the disabled preferences.
And then Section 11C on page 5, line 13, is that in existing statutes?
Yes, sir. That the reason that that is in there, Mr. Chair, is because domestic insurer by statute does not have to obtain an Alaska business license. So if we keep the preference consistent for them, they would have to get a business license, which they don't typically do in that industry. So this just sort of equates them not having to have the business license and still they would still have to qualify for all the other elements of the Alaska bidder preference.
Okay. Other questions? Don't see any. All right. Thank you for the overview. Let's go on to public testimony. We have Scott Thorson on the line. Scott, welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record, give us your testimony.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
My name is Scott Thorson. I'm testifying from Anchorage. I own a small IT services firm here. I've been participating in various Alaska state procurements for approximately the last 20 years in my current company. I've also participated in state of Alaska procurements going back to the early 80s in other companies that I work for. I support House Bill 205 because I think it really does good work in cleaning up, simplifying, and clarifying a lot of these statutes. We do a lot of work for a lot of different companies and organizations outside of the state in my company, but typically, responding to state procurements is, from a business exercise perspective, it's one of the more complicated processes that we go through. And I really compliment Representative Faircloth and Mr. Jones for their efforts in kind of getting the business community together and getting support from the state chamber and a few other places for this bill and for it's not really a companion bill, but House Bill 204. I think these bills both go a long way toward doing business with the state a lot easier and a lot more efficient. I also very much appreciate the benefits, I guess you can call them, that the state provides for locally owned businesses. In my business, the cost of doing business here in Alaska, having Alaska-based employees, is far higher than it is for some of my competitors that are offshore and down in the lower 48. And these preferences go a long way towards sort of leveling that playing field and making it so that we as an IT services firm can participate in doing business with the state on a little bit more level playing field. In conclusion, I really strongly support House Bill 205. I think it's really a good bill, and I think I'd really appreciate if you guys could pass that along to the next stage. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Anyone else online wanting to testify? Anyone else in the room wanting to testify? See anyone? Let's close public testimony. Okay. Let's. Any final comments?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your consideration.
Okay. Thank you. If you can get us that information on the disability changes, I appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, let's set that bill aside. We're going to move on now to House Bill 169, which addresses Legislative Affairs Agency Review of Regulations. Representative Gatto's staff, Lisa Munson, is here to describe House Bill 169. Do we have anyone here from Representative Gatto's committee or what, Representative Gatto's office? All right, well, let's move on to the next one. Move up to House Bill 216, which deals with regulations. House Bill 216 would set expectations for completion of regulations and make explanations of regulations clearly understandable in, quote, plain English. Representative Wilson, here to present the bill. Representative Wilson. Take brief eddies. Back on the record, Representative Wilson, welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record and present your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Peggy Wilson from House District 2. And House Bill 216 deals with two problems that come up quite frequently. Really two frustrations that we all kind of experience. And one is they're with state regulations, and one is that state agencies don't always get the regulations done in a timely manner. And sometimes it's been years, actually, without a regulation in place, leaving those affected unable to move forward. An instance is last year when we did House Bill 110, the regulations weren't quite in place yet, and so when we were looking in committee to try to debate and decide what we were going to do to change the regulations and to change our rules, we couldn't compare apples with apples because the regulations weren't in place.
And so at times it's very difficult. And generally, members of the public and even us legislators, when we get the little notification either by email or the card in the mail saying that a regulation is going to be changed, it's not, it's in legalese, and so it's hard to understand what it is. And it's even hard for, I've had some legislators that are attorneys say that it's even hard for them to understand it. And if we go to the statute and look, we still don't understand what's going on. So House Bill 216 will increase understanding of state regulations by the public and legislators in two ways. Section 1 will ensure that the state regulations are completed and adopted in a timely manner. And Section 2 will ensure that all new regulations and changes to current regulations are accompanied by a brief description in plain English so that we can understand it. And so here's a brief rundown of the key points. Section 1, the deadlines for adopting or amending or repealing regulations are set by the department or the agencies, not by the legislators. So in other words, and we're envisioning that on the fiscal note, the department will say, we think it's going to take 9 months for us to get these regulations in place. So we aren't telling them what to do or anything. We just want them to give us an idea of how long it'll take and when those regulations will be in place. And while most state boards and commissions, if they haven't met their deadline, they have to go, have to report to the Reg Review Committee if they miss that deadline, and then tell why and what the revised date will be. And while most state boards and commissions that we have in the state, because they meet very infrequently, and because they aren't really exempt, we've exempted them in this reason, in this section, and the reason we've exempted them is because they don't have the timelines that we do, and you know, it's the hairdresser's board, and for them to have a timeline, they're working on that, and we're not concerned about it. But with state agencies, it's a different story, and there are a few boards that we work with quite frequently that we do want to know. And so the ones that aren't exempt are the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, the Alaska Energy Authority, and the Alaska Public Offices Commission, and the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. They must set deadlines because they're working with us quite a bit. In Section 2, the brief description must accompany all notices furnished in the paper or on paper through the mail, via email, or on the public line notice system. Now, I wanted to be sure that we were not forcing agencies to have to spend more money in informing the public. And because of that reason, agencies do not to include that brief description in newspapers or trade or industry publications. And that's because they have to pay by the line and or by the word, actually. And so newspapers actually were really concerned that they were going to lose money because we were pulling the notifications out of the newspapers. That wasn't the fact at all. And in fact, they probably will get a little bit more because in those publications and in those newspapers, they have to say where they can go to find the brief description in plain English. So it might be the library, it might be their web page, whatever. And Section 2 also makes it clear that individuals cannot take action against agencies if the brief description was misunderstood. We just wanted to make sure that we can, it's something that we can easily understand and the general public could. And then Sections 3 and 4 state that these requirements apply only to bills that are filed after the effective date of July 1st of this year. That's the new fiscal year, and we thought that would be a good time. So the fiscal note states that no cost is anticipated as a result of Section 1, and the fiscal impact resulting from Section 2 is expected to be minimal. As agencies and departments are writing or revising regulations, they are to already articulate the intent in plain English. So adding those words to notices that go out to the public should be fairly simple. And I believe this bill will improve public participation in the political process, as people will understand what the regulation is to mean. And it will also make it easier for legislators to evaluate whether the intent of the statute is actually implemented in the regulation. So thank you for this, hearing this bill, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you for the presentation. Questions? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Wilson, for the bill. As your bill's gone through the process, has the department given any reason why they can't do this or meet your requirements?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, no, they have not at all had any objection. The Department of Law in the beginning had some objections, and as we went through the process, we changed it accordingly so that they didn't have a problem with it.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chairman, and maybe it's in the bill, I just missed it. What are the repercussions if they don't meet the timeline?
They just have to report to the Reg Review Committee, and then they have to set a new time and tell why they didn't meet that deadline, and then set a new deadline.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. We do have someone from the Department of Law here. Steve Weaver, do you want to come forward, Steve?
If you have questions.
Yeah, why don't you come forward, put yourself on the record. We also have our legislative legal online if there are other questions. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Steve Weaver. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law Legislation Regulation Section.
Thank you. Does the administration have okay with this bill? Have any concerns about the bill?
Mr. Chair, this bill primarily presents policy considerations. I don't represent the view of the governor or any line agency on policy, of course. We did work with Representative Wilson's office to fine-tune the bill to make sure that it didn't produce any unexpected results. At this point, we have no legal issues with the bill.
Okay. Any questions for Department of Law? And either this is for you, Mr. Weaver, or for you, Representative Wilson, how would the plain English requirement work for a very complicated regulation on a topic, say, of computation of a oil production tax? Let me ask legal's perspective, do you think that's possible, and do you see any problems with that? And then I guess I'll turn it over
to Mr. Chair. I would imagine that the agencies would be tailoring their brief description to, you know, the nature of the bill. There are some bills that are going to be more complicated than others. Representative Wilson may be better suited to speak on where she was going with the bill. My impression is that a lot of the concern was with the overuse of jargon, for example, that would come as a surprise to legislators or members of the public. Simply not really saying in common terms what the regulations do. Representative Wilson?
Actually, my envisioning of this is very simple, actually. Right now, they say in AS 252-82-198, you know, they talk in that way, and then, you know, a person that's reading it has no clue even what the subject matter is, except that they know what department it came from. And so this would be, like, for a big tax bill, it could be simply that changes to the oil and gas taxes in the state of Alaska. You know, it could be as simple as that, so a normal person who's interested in the oil and tax issues would go, oh. And then they would be interested in it. It doesn't have to go into detail, but it has to at least have the subject matter, and in a big bill like that, that would be sufficient. But in a simpler bill, you might go into a little bit more detail because, you know, like if there's a change in fish regulations or something, they might want to say changing the...
your net size in the lower Yukon.
Right. You know, something simple as that.
Good example. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Let's go. We've got Terry Bannister online from Legislative Legal, and let's just get Terry's perspective. Terry, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You could put yourself on the record, and I know you're just available for questions, but I want to see if you have any concerns on the bill.
This is Terry Bannister. I am Legislative Legal Services. I think the concerns I have with the bill have been eliminated by working with the department and with the sponsor.
Okay.
I don't have any concerns with the bill.
Fair enough. Questions? I don't see any. We've got a couple people from Nome signed up to testify. And Jana Ferrati, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Put yourself on the record. And if you could, we're running out of time here. If you could limit your comments to about 2 or 3 minutes, that would be great.
It will be less than that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of this committee, and also sponsors of this bill. And let me just say that I really appreciate you hearing on House Bill 216 by teleconference in a time when sometimes it seems that the legislature and government is so far away, and we rely on phone calls and tweets and all of that stuff. Being able to speak in person is really important, and I appreciate it and want you to know that. So, as noted, I live in Nome, Alaska, which is a first-class city, and it's served by one weekly newspaper, which also serves the whole region and is distributed not only statewide but nationally. The Nome Nugget is legally the regional newspaper of general population. I think that's what it's legally called. And from it, we get not only our news but also official notifications. I really appreciate the intent of House Bill 216, both sections, especially the first, and the second to require notices to be written in language easily read or understood by real people. That's important, and I'm so happy to see it. I wonder why, though, however, this bill does not require notices mentioned in Section 2, lines 12 to 14, to include that brief description of the proposed action in newspapers. Newspapers in rural Alaska are the primary means by which we get information about state agency actions. Some people may be adept at looking up stuff online, and they have computers readily available. Most are not, including me. I'm actually just learning to use BASIS. Excluding the requirement for a brief description to be published in a newspaper of general circulation really doesn't make much sense to me. And in truth, state agencies are already not publishing required notices of meetings held in Nome. They come in and out of Nome, hold hearings, take actions, and nobody even knows that they were here except a few people who were selectively invited. It's really frustrating. And I support this bill, but ask it to be amended to require that the brief description, as noted in the bill, be published in newspapers of general circulation. I realize that that would cost a little bit more, but keeping citizens advised more than compensates for that cost. I thank you very much for hearing my opinion on this bill. I appreciate your time and the fact that you teleconferenced it.
All right. Thank you, John. Good to hear from you. I don't see any questions. Next up, we have Nancy McGuire, also from Nome. Nancy, welcome to the committee. If you could give us your testimony in about 3 minutes, we would appreciate it.
Okay, I'll talk fast. I'll not talk that fast. I'm going to say that I read House Bill 216 probably 216 times before I think I might have a vague idea what it's trying to say. But I'll get past that. What I'm looking at is the importance of keeping the public informed and open government. And I will fight for my readers. I take exception to the fact that it seems to be a money issue with the state. And their facts are wrong. We do not charge by the word. We charge by the line, and it's $1.15 a line at the Nome Nugget, FYI. And the other thing is, it says if the notice is published in newspapers. Now, I don't really like the idea of the if. The bill should read, it will be published in newspapers. Trade and industry publications are optional. I find it kind of self-serving if we put only mining notifications in the mining news or the petroleum news or whatever. So I hope that we can keep the public informed, and I hope that you will take that into consideration and revise the stating of that bill so that it says that it should be published in newspapers. And the Nome Nugget is the adjudicated newspaper for the 2nd Judicial District. So thank you very much for listening to my concerns, and I hope to keep the public informed.
Nancy, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else online wanting to testify? I don't see anyone else in the room wanting to testify. I don't see anyone with closed public testimony. Any final words, Representative Wilson, on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I do want to make a comment that we didn't change any of the requirements for notification. All of those requirements have not been changed, so they still will have to be required to make their notifications everywhere that they do now.
Was there a provision that required publication in newspapers, or is that something that was in a prior version?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We did have it that it was everywhere that they had to do, but the departments said that they have to do so many of these that it might seem like a little bit now, but that could add up, and so they requested that it not be in newspapers or publications. So we amended the...
Is there somewhere online? Do you know?
Through the chair. This is Steve Weaver again with the Department of Law. The requirements for distribution under the Administrative Procedure Act have not changed. Those are set out in AS 4462-190. They require a variety of notifications. The public notice itself must still be put in a newspaper. It's required for a newspaper of general circulation and for trade and industry journals. It still has to be mailed out or emailed to persons who have expressed interest in the project, or to persons that agencies believe are interested in the project. They have to be posted on the Alaska Online Public Notice. In addition, agencies also do additional outreach. The only thing that is addressed in this bill is the accompanying brief description.
Okay, great. Thank you. Questions? I don't see any. Okay, we're going to set the bill aside, and members have amendments if you could get them to Michelle by noon tomorrow. Appreciate it. Okay, thank you. All right, House Bill 169, is there anyone here on that? Okay, I don't see any. You lost your turn. All right, we're going to adjourn, and it's 10:25, return.